Welcome to MDS Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Mikhail Sekeres of the Cleveland Clinic, and to begin, he commented on the rapidly evolving area of genomics in the disease.
What we've seen over the past couple of years in myelodysplastic syndromes has really been an explosion in understanding of the genetics or genomics of these diseases. More and more, we're able to identify myelodysplastic syndromes as being a genetically based disease, and that's why we feel free to call it a cancer. There are a lot of gene panels that are available for people to order on behalf of their patients. They have made testing MDS with FISH panels a thing of yesteryear. So the standard approach we take with a patient with myelodysplastic syndromes is to offer that person a myeloid next-generation sequencing panel when they're first diagnosed. And these are panels that are available through a variety of companies that have anywhere from 25 to 60 of the most common genes found in myelodysplastic syndromes. Ordering one of these panels, you'll be able to identify a genetic basis to the myelodysplastic syndromes somewhere around 80 to 90% of the time. These are important for a couple of reasons. The first is it helps you prognostically. The second is sometimes it can identify a patient as having myelodysplastic syndromes when you weren't sure they did when they walked through the door. They've become increasingly important at distinguishing patients who have what we call ICUS, idiopathic cytopenia of undetermined significance, from somebody who has a formal diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndromes. Finally, they're going to be helping us with therapies. There's now one clinical trial of a drug called luspatercept, the eligibility criteria for which are patients who have either ring sideroblasts or who have an SF3B1 mutation. There's another drug specific for patients who have an SF3B1 abnormality.
These panels that you're talking about, do you think they're useful to an oncologist in community-based practice or more for research at this point?
Yeah, it's a great question, Neil. I think increasingly they're becoming useful in clinical practice, and I'll tell you why. One of the most common presentations somebody in a community practice or in an academic practice is going to have in a hematology clinic is a patient who has unexplained cytopenias. 70-year-old man walks through the door, has some anemia, hemoglobin of 9.8, a little bit of thrombocytopenia, platelet count of 123,000, and it's suspected that he has myelodysplastic syndromes. That man undergoes a bone marrow biopsy. Lo and behold, the pathologists come back and say, well, we see a couple of abnormal cells, but not enough to call it myelodysplastic syndrome. Those pathologists are not seeing the 10% dysplasia in one cell line that we need for the diagnosis. So they say, well, possibly myelodysplastic syndrome, but would exclude other causes of dysplasia, such as toxins or medications or a variety of other things. Sending one of these mutation panels can help lead to that diagnosis. If that man who has the mild dysplasia also has a TET2 abnormality, DNMT3A, RUNX1, you can feel pretty confident in saying that he has myelodysplastic syndromes.
You hear the term, the first place I heard this term was in breast cancer, but I've heard it now in other cancers of so-called intrinsic subtypes. Does that exist with MDS?
Can you explain that a little bit more since I'm not in the breast cancer arena?
It sounds like it's connected to what you're talking about now, that by looking at genomic patterns, you can define genetically different subtypes within the disease. Is that kind of happening with MDS?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We do see genetic abnormalities that are more common in certain subtypes. So for example, spliceosome mutations such as the SF3B1 have now been linked to patients who have MDS with ring sideroblasts. And for that reason, the WHO brought back a category it had eliminated years ago. We've always had refractory anemia with ring sideroblasts. We now have MDS with multilineage dysplasia with ring sideroblasts, which was taken away in the last iteration of the WHO. That's one subtype that can be defined. And another one, of course, that people recognize is MDS with the deletion 5q abnormality. These patients have a different underlying biology, a different responsiveness to drugs, and a different survival than patients who don't have the deletion 5q. Finally, we're able to identify patients who have genetic abnormalities along certain pathways. For example, patients who have abnormalities along methylation pathways, DNMT3A, TET2, IDH, may be more responsive to the so-called hypomethylating drugs.
So I see that you had two, maybe you had more, but I see two presentations at ASH kind of sounds like related to what you're talking about now. One, NGS-based copy number analysis in 1,185 patients with myeloid neoplasms. And then the other, frequency and prognostic significance of cytogenetic abnormalities in 1,269 patients with therapy-related MDS. Can you talk about what you presented with these two presentations?
Sure. Well, with the first presentation, we're getting more sophisticated at running these molecular abnormalities in patients who have myelodysplastic syndromes and identifying how many abnormalities there are in each of these patients. I can give you one example. A related publication we had that just came out in Nature Genetics identified that a typical patient with myelodysplastic syndromes has 9 distinct genetic abnormalities. Now, not all of these are so-called driver mutations, meaning that we can tell that the genetics went from abnormality A to abnormality B to abnormality C to lead to the disease. Some of those are what are referred to sometimes as quote-unquote innocent bystanders, but you can see in a study like this how complex a disease is myelodysplastic syndromes. It's not a one-hit wonder like chronic myeloid leukemia, where you have one abnormality and then you'll have the leukemia. With myelodysplastic syndromes, you develop one abnormality probably earlier in life, and then develop subsequent abnormalities until the disease becomes manifest at the age of 70. So a new area we're going with this type of research is actually looking at germline abnormalities. We divide genetic abnormalities into two types: germline, meaning you're born with it, or somatic abnormalities, meaning you acquire it over your lifetime. Well, it turns out there are probably a lot more of these patients with myelodysplastic syndromes who have germline abnormalities or somatic abnormalities they acquire at a younger age, and it takes decades until they acquire the additional genetic abnormalities that leads to the myelodysplastic syndromes.
Germline. So you're saying it's some kind of genetic predisposition, essentially an inherited MDS?
Exactly. And this research started from a patient I saw in clinic, a man who was 66 at the time, who revealed to us that he had an identical twin who also had myelodysplastic syndrome.
Wow.
His brother came in, saw us. They both generously donated some of their blood for research purposes, and we found that they both had a genetic abnormality called the dead box helicase or DDX41 abnormality. When we initially presented these two twins at the American Society of Hematology annual meeting, two other groups came up to us, one from Germany and one from Japan, and said, "Hey, guess what? We think we have families with DDX41 also." So we combined all of our data and described for the first time these families where people were born with the DDX41 abnormality and you have either leukemia or myelodysplastic syndromes that crosses generations. Now, one of the really cool aspects of this is that these brothers both were treated with lenalidomide. Neither had the deletion 5q abnormality. Both responded to lenalidomide and responded in spades, where they had a protracted response to receiving only 2 months of therapy, one brother for 6 months and one for 12 months. When we went back to our database and looked at all of our patients who had the DDX41 abnormality and had been treated with lenalidomide, 100% of them responded to the lenalidomide.
So you're saying people with somatic mutations?
So interestingly, these brothers had germline mutations. In our database, we discovered a mix of patients who had either germline, they were born with them, or somatic, they acquired DDX41.
But the patients with somatic responded just as well.
You got it.
Wow.
You got it.
Yeah, I just heard about, believe it or not, I don't know if you ever heard of T790 mutations in lung cancer. Maybe you picked that. I don't know if you ever round on lung cancer patients. I just found out they have germline T790 lung cancer mutations. But this is really wild with MDS. I never heard about that. That's interesting.
It's really cool. And there's actually a really neat epidemiologic study that supports the fact that you develop these abnormalities early and develop the disease decades later. There was a study that was conducted by the Atomic Bomb Disease Institute in Japan. And what these folks do is track every person who's been exposed to the atomic bomb in Japan for decades. They have information about where that person was when the atomic bombs were dropped, so they have precise dosimetry data of their exposure. And they track these folks for disease. In this one study, remember the bombs were dropped in 1945, they looked for the incidence rate of myelodysplastic syndrome occurring in the 1980s and 1990s, so 40 or 50 years after exposure to the atomic bomb. And what they found was that those patients exposed to the atomic bomb had a 17-fold higher rate of developing myelodysplastic syndromes than those who weren't.
Wow. And was there a dosimetry thing with the closer they were, the more the MDS?
Absolutely. You nailed it. So the closer they were, the higher their dose, the more likely they were to develop myelodysplastic syndromes. But think about the implications of that epidemiologic study. An exposure 40 or 50 years earlier led to the occurrence of a disease. So it remained quiescent for that period of time, meaning you developed a lesion, a genetic abnormality from the radiation exposure, and then it took decades for additional abnormalities to arise until you had myelodysplastic syndrome. If you think about it from a germline genetics abnormality perspective, you're born with something. It's not crazy to think that even though you're born with it, whereas traditionally we think of patients who have Lynch syndrome or BRCA1 or 2 as getting colon cancer or breast cancer in their 30s and 40s, it's not crazy to think that you can actually have a delay until your 60s or 70s to get myelodysplastic syndrome.
That's fascinating. I'm looking at your abstract on this the other one I was mentioning. I'm still trying to figure out what you looked at. These were people who had treatment-related MDS?
Yeah, so another area of study, this was an international study led by Andrea Kungen from Germany, where we and others contributed information about our patients with therapy-related myelodysplastic syndromes and were able to identify some things that we knew and some things that we didn't about how they differed from patients who had de novo MDS. So that's more of a broader study. It's no surprise that patients who had therapy-related myelodysplastic syndromes were more likely to have complex cytogenetics or chromosome 7 abnormalities. The next step in this research is to try to identify what you were referring to earlier as a genomic signature for patients who have therapy-related disease as opposed to de novo disease. Because at the end of the day, we assume that somebody has a therapy-related MDS when they were treated for a cancer previously. They may not. They may just have bad luck. They may have a predilection for developing cancer and get two cancers as opposed to one that's caused by the first.
Interesting. Right now, are there any therapeutic implications?
There are some therapeutic implications because if you read textbooks, people will often write cavalierly that therapy-related MDS is a much worse disease and these folks should be transplanted right off the bat. Whereas we know from decision analyses that we should wait to transplant patients who have lower risk disease, and those who have higher risk disease, we should be transplanting right up front. So we shouldn't make the assumption, first of all, that someone has therapy-related MDS, or secondly, that that therapy-related MDS is any worse than de novo MDS with the same characteristics.
Interesting. Again, before we get into your cases, you mentioned the agent luspatercept, and I think there's another one, sotatercept. And when I heard it, the first thing I thought about was aflibercept that we know from colon cancer, the VEGF trap. So I'm thinking this is maybe in some way related chemically. What are these agents?
Yeah, so luspatercept and sotatercept are very similar. They're TGF-beta inhibitors. If you think of myelodysplastic syndromes, what distinguishes lower risk from higher risk? Lower risk MDS, you have the predomination of pro-apoptotic, pro-inflammatory cytokines. In other words, you have cells that die too quickly. In higher risk MDS, it looks a lot more like acute leukemia in older adults. You have the predomination of proliferative signals, and you have a block in differentiation. That's why you get excess blasts with higher risk MDS. So if you're targeting lower risk MDS, you really want to try to sustain cells and keep them alive and try to block those pro-inflammatory, pro-apoptotic cytokines. So that's what this drug does. Sotatercept is similar, and the company that manufactures these has decided to go in a route of developing luspatercept for MDS and sotatercept for thalassemia. So moving forward right now, there is a study that's open. It's a registration trial. Patients with ring sideroblasts or the SF3B1 abnormality who are transfusion dependent and have either been exposed to an erythropoiesis stimulating agent or are unlikely to respond to one, and they are randomized to getting luspatercept or to getting placebo.
And what do we know right now? Are there any clinical research information available with either one of these agents?
There were two phase two studies that were conducted, luspatercept in Europe and sotatercept in the US. Both reported overall response rates of 40 to 45%, but higher response rates, more like 60% in patients who had ring sideroblasts. And that's why they decided to move forward in the ring sideroblast population.
Now, this is a single agent?
It is a single agent. It's given every 3 weeks, so similar in how it's dosed to darbepoetin, and it works on late-stage erythropoiesis, so promoting that.
So it's really, is it an anti-neoplastic?
It depends on whom you talk to, whether it's an anti-neoplastic or more of a growth factor.
Fascinating. What do you think? What would you call it?
I think it's somewhere in between. It's certainly more than just giving a hormone to somebody, but it's probably not as much of a chemotherapeutic as, say, a hypomethylating agent like decitabine.
Any tolerability issues?
So far, so good. Well tolerated, very few side effects reported, and almost no serious side effects to it.
And again, this is like a fusion protein?
It is. It is.
Fascinating. Why don't we go on and we can get into some of the other things that have come out in terms of new research, maybe through your cases. And why don't we begin and talk about your 76-year-old man?
Sure. One of the patients I saw recently was a 76-year-old man with a history of heart disease who was initially referred to a hematologist with anemia and leukopenia. At that time, he had a hemoglobin of 8.5, and his white blood cell count had dropped to 3.1, and then down even further to 2,000 with a neutrophil count of 1,300. He underwent a workup for vitamin deficiencies. Those were all normal. We normally test people for things like B12 or folate and even check thyroid studies to make sure that hypothyroidism isn't causing anemia, particularly macrocytic anemia. He eventually underwent a bone marrow biopsy and aspirate, and that showed that he had refractory cytopenia with multilineage dysplasia with ring sideroblasts present. He had 4% blasts at the time, and his doctor sent cytogenetics that came back with a deletion 5q and a trisomy 8 abnormality. A myeloid mutation panel also showed a UTAF1 mutation, a spliceosome mutation, in addition to the things I've already mentioned. So we have a 76-year-old man with refractory cytopenia with multilineage dysplasia, with ring sideroblasts, and with a deletion 5q abnormality, who has anemia and neutropenia, this mild degree of neutropenia.
So can you talk a little bit about how you thought through his case and what you did?
Sure. You know, this patient has lower risk myelodysplastic syndromes. He doesn't have excess blasts. He doesn't have a chromosome 7 abnormality or chromosome 3 or complex cytogenetics. And he has some cytopenias. He has a decent amount of anemia and mild neutropenia, but no thrombocytopenia. So this patient would have lower risk disease, and we treat lower risk MDS patients a little bit differently than we do those with higher risk disease. If you have higher risk MDS, your median survival can be measured in less than a year and a half. We consider that a serious disease, just as we would stage 3 or 4 lung cancer. And in fact, if you look stage for stage between myelodysplastic syndromes and non-small cell lung cancer, the survival for myelodysplastic syndromes is worse. So when somebody comes with advanced myelodysplastic syndrome, we treat them immediately regardless of their peripheral blood counts, right? Our goal is to prolong their survival and to try to prevent transformation to acute leukemia. For somebody with lower risk disease, and I will sometimes joke, one of my patients referred to that as mild displeasure syndrome, it may just be a mild displeasure. It may be something that requires that you get into a car and drive into Cleveland every month or two or every 6 months to have your blood counts checked, and then you leave and go about your life. Your goals with lower risk patients are to preserve quality of life and to try to minimize transfusions, because no drug we have has ever prospectively been shown to improve survival with lower risk MDS. So I would view a patient like this and I would think to myself, okay, is his quality of life impaired? Well, the hemoglobin of 8.5 at his age, he's feeling it. He's tired and he will require blood transfusions. Now, if I have a patient who's requiring a blood transfusion every 2, 3, or 4 months, you know what? That's probably not too much of an impact on his quality of life. On the other hand, if I have a patient who's starting to require blood transfusions and that requirement is every month or even more frequently than that, that's an impact on quality of life, and that's someone in whom we need to intervene. Now, for lower risk MDS, the majority of patients are started on erythropoiesis stimulating agents. The likelihood that somebody's going to respond to an ESA with lower risk MDS, if you take all comers, is somewhere between about 20 to 40%, depending on the study you look at. So it's a wide range because these studies are conducted differently. For somebody who has a low serum EPO level, so a serum EPO level that's less than 100, for example, and somebody who hasn't yet required blood transfusions, the likelihood that he or she is going to respond to an ESA is more like 75%. So we do check serum EPO levels in patients like this. In his case, his serum EPO level came back at 96, and he's somebody I started on an erythropoiesis stimulating agent, even though he had the deletion 5q abnormality.
And what's his current situation?
So we started the erythropoiesis stimulating agent, and he's been on it for about 10 weeks. I give it at the regimen that was conducted in the U.S. The lead author is Janet Gabrielov, published a while ago, 2008, in British Journal of Hematology. That regimen is to give darbepoetin 500 mics every 3 weeks. And if somebody doesn't respond after about 10 weeks of therapy, you decrease the frequency to every 2 weeks. So he hasn't responded yet, and we've just decreased the frequency to every 2 weeks.
I'm curious. I see that he has a history of coronary artery disease, but globally, how did you explain to him sort of what was wrong? Did you tell him he had a cancer? And what did you say to him about what to expect for the future?
I love this question, Neil, and I love it because it's one of my soapboxes. We've done a couple of studies in collaboration with the Aplastic Anemia and MDS Foundation. They are a patient advocacy group. And one of the questions we asked patients was, how is MDS first described to you? They made available their email lists of MDS patients. So we sent emails to over 3,000 patients with myelodysplastic syndromes, and about 350 responded. Now, you may hear those numbers and think, oh my God, you had an 11% response rate. That's terrible. But if you think, as you're checking your email every day and every time you see a subject header in brackets that says possible bulk email and how many times you delete it immediately, for this sort of research, 11% is actually considered pretty good. When we asked patients, how is MDS first described to you, over 80% said it was initially described as either a blood disorder or a bone marrow disorder. When we said, how often was it described to you as cancer or leukemia, only 6 or 7% of patients responded that it had been. So reflect back on what I said a little bit earlier. If you consider the IPSS, the International Prognostic Scoring System, a default staging system for MDS, and IPSS low, intermediate 1, intermediate 2, and high represent stages 1, 2, 3, and 4 for MDS, stage for stage, survival is worse for MDS than it is for non-small cell lung cancer. So what happens to me commonly is somebody's referred to me having been told that she has a blood disorder or a bone marrow disorder out of innocent reasons. No one wants to scare a 76-year-old and say you have cancer. But then when that person comes to me and says, well, how are you going to treat this, doc? And I say, we're going to give chemotherapy. She looks at me as if I have four heads. What do you mean? I have a blood disorder. You're going to use chemotherapy for that? So it sets us back with our relationship, the trust that we have in our patients, if we don't at least mention how serious these diseases are, and we don't have to club somebody over the head with it. If somebody has refractory anemia with ring sideroblast with a little mild anemia, a normal karyotype, low blast percentage, I don't have to say to them, you have cancer, and start lighting candles around the room as we all kneel down and hold hands, right? It's not that serious. But somebody who has higher risk MDS with a blast percentage of 18%, who already has multiple cytopenias and complex cytogenetics, that person is not going to live very long. And we have to let them know that.
You know, it's funny, I was talking to Steve Gore as part of the same program, and of course, he brought that up. Everybody always brings that up. And I was just, I never thought about it, but did anybody ever think of changing the name of the disease? And and if you could, what would you call it?
You know, the name of myeloproliferative conditions was changed from myeloproliferative disorders to myeloproliferative neoplasms.
Right.
So I wonder if we changed it to myelodysplastic neoplasms.
Yeah.
Or something with a little more drama to it, if people would get the point. And, you know, based on that research that we did, Aplastic Anemia and MDS Foundation now in their patient education materials mentions that some people consider this to be a cancer. They want people to hear it from them rather than going on the internet and being scared by it randomly.
So what exactly did you say to this man? How did you explain it to him?
You know, it's a good question. What I say to my patients, because I'm not sure what they're aware of, is I first ask them, well, you know, your doctor sent you to me. What is it you were told that you have?
So what did this man say? Do you remember?
Well, I do, actually. He said, well, you know, they did a bone marrow biopsy, and boy, did that hurt. Ooh, I wouldn't want to go through that again. And I hear a little bit about how terrible a bone marrow biopsy is. And he said, and then they said that I had this bone marrow disorder, this bone marrow problem. And I said, well, did they give it a name? And he said, yeah, they called it that Milo, people stumble over the words. And I think it's important for us to acknowledge that and say, yeah, we've got this god-awful name for these things. It's called myelodysplastic syndromes, or MDS. Then what I will say to folks, and often, it's rare that I have a patient who comes to one of my appointments alone. So either there's a spouse in the room or there's a child in the room. In this case, there was a spouse in the room. And what I say is, you know, here are these conditions. This is how they arise. I talk about how the bone marrow works and then what happens when it works abnormally. Talk about what red blood cells and white blood cells and platelets do so everyone understands what we're talking about. I actually read the bone marrow report on the electronic medical record to my patient and review the words with them so they understand them also. And then I'll say, you know, if you go on the internet, some people may refer to this as a cancer. And I judge their reaction. Sometimes they nod a lot because they've already been on the internet and they've seen that. And sometimes I'll see someone's eyes go wide. And based on that reaction, I'll then go into it a little bit and try to put it in context.
So in this man, I'm kind of curious what you said to him about what to expect in the future, what he asked you.
So I talked about some of our theories for treating lower risk myelodysplastic syndromes. We concentrate on what's bugging somebody the most. His main complaint is fatigue. This is a man who's not getting a lot of infections. I don't have to worry about the white blood cells as much. Because by a person's disease course, he or she will let you know what the biggest problem is. I have some patients who walk around with a neutrophil count of 200 and haven't gotten a common cold in years. These are people I don't have to correct the neutrophils. The number is low, but functionally, they've proven themselves. For him, it was anemia, which means we needed to focus on that. If he had two problems, if he was getting infections and he had anemia, then my recommendation for him wouldn't have been just to give an erythropoiesis-stimulating agent because I wouldn't have made a dent in the neutrophils by giving that. Instead, I would have probably recommended either a hypomethylating agent or an immune approach such as antithymocyte globulin, something that will treat more than one cell line.
And did he say, you know, what's the chance that, you know, I will die of this in 2-3 years, for example? Or did you get into survival? And if he had asked you, what would you have said?
So for somebody like him, you know, somebody with lower risk disease, but he does have refractory cytopenia with multilineage dysplasia. He has a couple of cytogenetic abnormalities, one of which is very good. And, you know, he'd still be, even in the revised IPSS, he'd still be in a good category with what we call a 5Q minus plus one other abnormality. He has a spliceosome mutation. It's not a particularly poor risk one. He'll fall somewhere in the middle of survival. We're probably talking about a median of about 3.5 years, 4 years, something like that. So it's not something that it's an emergency, but it is something that's probably going to compromise his natural survival. So for somebody like him, I talk about how survival is measured in years and not months, but that anything can happen, right? You still have to look both ways crossing Euclid Avenue in Cleveland, right? So we talk about it in those terms. He didn't ask me for best case, worst case scenarios, and with his level of disease, I wouldn't have expected it. With somebody with a higher risk MDS, I will talk about how it's a serious disease. We need to start therapy soon, and we need to try to prevent this from going into leukemia. I have to start using more serious terms because it could evolve, and it could evolve quickly. For a person like that who says, what would my survival be like? I give best case, worst case scenarios. So I'll say, well, have you seen anything online yet? What have you learned? Let me see what they hear. And sometimes people say, well, I didn't like what I saw online, right? So in that case, I have to say, well, if you're looking online, here are the average survival for somebody with higher risk MDS. We're probably talking about, you know, a year. But my best case patient has been alive for 5 years and counting. My worst case patient was alive for a couple of months.
I would imagine it's not uncommon, and maybe this man might have brought up the question of new and exciting approaches that even an experimental level that might be considered. Almost every oncologist tells me, no matter what cancer people walk in with nowadays, they ask about checkpoint inhibitors because, you know, it's on TV all the time. And I was going to ask you about checkpoint inhibitors with MDS. But how would you respond to a patient who says, you know, I've heard about immunotherapy. Is there anything exciting that maybe could be in my immediate future?
Yeah, it's a great question. For somebody like him, what I would probably say is that a lot of the new trials enroll patients for whom erythropoiesis stimulating agents either haven't worked or are unlikely to work. So our first step is to try an ESA if you're interested in new therapies. Again, for somebody like him, lower risk disease. We mentioned already luspatercept. He might be a candidate for something like that if, once again, he has to have been exposed to an ESA that didn't work or stopped working before he can go on to a study like that. Another thing I would consider in him is we talked about hypomethylating agents. The way that hypomethylating agents are approved by the FDA is probably not the right dose for patients with lower risk MDS. With higher risk MDS, we give azacitidine for 7 days in a 28-day cycle. And in those patients, we have a survival advantage for azacitidine versus conventional care regimens. So either best supportive care, that was 60% of the control group in the AZA-001 study, or low-dose cytarabine, or 7 plus 3 AML type of therapy, right? In those patients, we have a survival advantage for that regimen, and that's not something we muck around with. For lower-risk patients, the data are less clear-cut, and they're less randomized. So we have response rates of 30 to 40% in large series or real-world populations, but it may be that less is more with these patients. So we've engaged in a study with some other centers in which patients with lower risk MDS are randomized to receiving azacitidine for 5 days out of every 28, or azacitidine for 3 days every 28, or D-cytidine for 3 days every 28. And what we're finding preliminarily is that the overall response rate is no different for those patients who are getting less of a drug than those who are getting close to what the standard would be, 5 days.
As long as we're talking about hypomethylating agents, what about oral agents and where do you see that heading?
Yeah, there are a couple of approaches to this. One, of course, there's an oral azacitidine study that's targeting lower risk MDS patients. That's still accruing patients. Another approach is to use oral D-cytidine. And there was a presentation at ASH of an oral approach to D-cytidine, which looked like it had acceptable response rates. What I'm not seeing, Neil, is any improvement in response rates over the IV or sub-Q administrations of these drugs.
Do you think from a quality of life point of view, there's a significant difference? And do you think that somehow sort of the pharmacodynamics of this could be played to a therapeutic advantage?
You know, both are great questions. Just starting with the pharmacodynamics or pharmacokinetics of these drugs, those are going to have to be assessed. If it was a straight trade-off one-to-one, then I suspect that there would have been a cross-approval with the IV or sub-Q formulation, right? So it's slightly different, but slightly different may be okay. Like I mentioned with the study in which we're participating, less may be more, or different patterns to the pharmacokinetics may be better for patients with lower risk MDS. You may want more of a protracted exposure to a drug as opposed to a 7 days out of every 28. From a quality of life perspective, you know, it depends on what aspect of quality of life you're talking about. It is certainly better to be in the comfort of your own home, opening a bottle and taking a pill every day, than it is to slog into clinic and take a shot through your vein or underneath your skin. And it's often more than one shot. If you're talking about azacitidine, you're usually getting two shots or even three shots a day, depending on your weight and height. But if you're talking about quality of life perspective from fighting with insurance companies, it may be easier to get the shots. If you're on Medicare, azacitidine, decitabine in clinic, this is an on-label indication of a chemotherapeutic. It's paid for. Pills aren't necessarily paid for depending on the subtype of Medicare that you have.
Interesting. So before we go on to your next case, I did want to hear from you what's going on in terms of new and exciting things. I would curious about checkpoint inhibitors. I've heard about that with hypomethylating agents. Also want to hear about venetoclax.
Yeah. So starting with checkpoint inhibitors, there were a couple of studies that were presented at ASH in December of 2016 looking at these in patients with MDS. One particular oral presentation looked at a checkpoint inhibitor as a single agent. Another one added it to azacitidine. Now, in looking over these patients, they were a bit of a gamish. You didn't have all isolated higher risk patients. You didn't have all patients for whom a hypomethylating agent had failed them. You had some who were de novo, some for whom hypomethylating agents didn't work out. You had some lower risk MDS, some higher risk MDS, even some oligoblastic leukemia in these studies. So it's very hard to take these studies and compare them one for one with other studies that have been conducted in these populations. That being said, my best take on the overall response rate in patients for whom hypomethylating agents have failed them is that as a single agent or in combination with a hypomethylating agent, the checkpoint inhibitors are not a home run the way they are in other diseases. Overall response rates are low, and you need to focus on real responses. So real responses would be CR, PR, hematologic improvement, and those overall response rates are low.
Although, you know, home run in a lot of these cancers, lung cancer, for example, is a 20% response rate. But I think where the home run has been, or people think it is duration of response. Again, any hints about response rate, but particularly any prolonged responses?
Yeah, there are anecdotes of a couple of patients who have these prolonged responses, but nothing that I'm seeing played out systematically across MDS. And the overall response rates, again, low, meaning real responses, you're probably talking about 10%. So we're not even at that 20% bar of lung cancer. We're certainly not at the response rates that have been seen in lymphomas or melanoma.
Right. What about venetoclax?
Yeah, venetoclax has reported out earlier on very impressive response rates in the 70 to 80% range. Again, what we're waiting on from venetoclax is response duration.
All right, well, let's move on. Why don't we talk about your 60-year-old lady?
Sure. So another person I saw was a 60-year-old woman who had beta thalassemia and as a result, a chronic microcytic anemia, who noted some worse bruising a couple of years ago. She went to her primary care physician and it showed, of course, her microcytic anemia from her thalassemia along with some thrombocytopenia. She underwent a bone marrow biopsy that showed a hypercellular bone marrow with a cellularity of 60%. And at her age, you would expect a cellularity of approximately 40%. She had a little bit of fibrosis, no blasts, and she had some ring sideroblasts, but not enough to call myelodysplastic syndrome with ring sideroblasts. She underwent a molecular mutation panel that showed an SF3B1 mutation at 30%, so a spliceosome mutation, and she had another missense mutation of CEBPα. Her bone marrow biopsy itself, this is one instance where her morphology really didn't lend itself to an exclusive diagnosis under the World Health Organization, but in the setting of two molecular abnormalities, she was felt very strongly to have a myeloid malignancy and most likely an overlap disorder of myelodysplastic syndrome and a myeloproliferative neoplasm.
So how did you manage her?
So she's tricky. She's very smart. She understood this. This is a complicated discussion to have with folks where you say, well, your bone marrow really doesn't say it exclusively, but we sent these genetic panels and let me describe to you what they are and what they mean. And so we think that you have this diagnosis. And in her case, she had an anemia that we really attributed to her thalassemia. She had a thrombocytopenia with a platelet count of around 100,000, so no need to intervene. So we are following a watch and wait approach with her. You know, that can be a good news, bad news to patients. People come to us and they expect a diagnosis. You know, particularly if you're at a referral center that has a public presence, people expect that they're going to come to you. You're going to give them a diagnosis and a way to treat what they have. So when you send somebody away from your clinic and you send them away with almost a diagnosis or a strongly suspect diagnosis, that can be frustrating. Some people would rather have a diagnosis, even if it's a bad one, to know what they have than to be reassured that they don't have something very serious, but you can't quite tell them what they have. And in her case, you know, she was able to get her head around this and understand this, but did want more frequent follow-up to make sure that her blood counts weren't changing too dramatically. So we see her about every 3 months.
And what do you see for her future? And if she does need to be treated, how would you treat her?
Yeah, she's 60 years old, so she's young for my patient population. She came to me about a decade too early, and maybe that's what the problem is, right? We're doing more tests on people. We're discovering these almost diagnoses at preternaturally younger ages, and then we're managing expectations for a decade when we should have just made the diagnosis when it came about a little more naturally at age 70, right? So for her, she could go along for years without any evolution. There's one gentleman I follow whom I have now followed for 13 years with myelodysplastic syndrome with no intervention.
Wow.
And for sure he has it. He has a lower risk MDS. He has ring sideroblasts, but hasn't required any therapy. So for him, it's managing expectations. And for her, it's going to be like that also. And I've seen both flavors of these. I've seen folks where I follow them for years. We get to know each other. I learn about their grandkids. And I never have to offer them a drop of therapy. And we joke that they come to see me for their well baby check. I have other patients where they have, with the exact same picture, evolved from this to acute leukemia within months. And that's why the most important part of this is just making sure people don't slip through the cracks.
When you do treat these patients with mixed disorders, what kinds of treatments do you use?
Yeah, it's another great question. This is kind of an orphan population. We've got drugs approved for MDS. We've got drugs approved for MPNs, but we don't have drugs specifically approved for the overlap. You have some folks who've snuck on to registration studies for MDS with chronic myelomonocytic leukemia. That's an overlap disorder. So what we do is we beg, borrow, and steal from each of those exclusive diagnoses to treat these folks who have an overlap, and we treat them depending on what's predominating at the time we see them. So if somebody comes to me, has a very high white count, let's say 20, 30,000, has some degree of anemia, has an enlarged spleen, that's a person I'm going to treat more like a myeloproliferative neoplasm. For somebody like that, we actually just completed a phase 2 study, and we've published the phase 1 results in Clinical Cancer Research of giving ruxolitinib for patients with chronic myelomonocytic leukemia. And we saw in those patients responses, both typical MPN responses of a shrinkage in spleen size, but also some corrections of anemia, something you might see more with MDS. Somebody like that, I might also, if that person has anemia, I might consider using lenalidomide. It's been looked at in the phase 2 setting in myeloproliferative neoplasms, and also, of course, it's approved for deletion 5q and lower risk MDS, and we'd expect a response rate to be pretty similar to that of MDS. Somebody who has an overlap disorder with multiple cytopenias, I would treat like somebody with MDS with multiple cytopenias and use a hypomethylating agent. And again, if you've looked at large case series of responsiveness to hypomethylating agents, it's about the same in overlap disorders as it is with MDS, with an overall response rate of somewhere in the mid-30s.
So let's go on and hear about your 84-year-old man.
Sure. I recently saw an 84-year-old man who was diagnosed with a, quote, myeloproliferative neoplasm almost 10 years ago. At that time, he had a platelet count of 550,000. He had a normal hemoglobin, and he had a white count that was normal as well. He was treated with hydroxyurea initially, and then about 4 years ago, his hemoglobin started to drop, and he was treated by another doctor with erythropoiesis-stimulating agent, and that did help his anemia. He was JAK2 negative, and then with subsequent bone marrow biopsies, it was illuminated that he didn't have a pure MPN. He actually had refractory anemia with ring sideroblasts and thrombocytosis. That was a provisional category under the former iteration of the WHO. That is now officially an overlap myelodysplastic syndrome, myeloproliferative neoplasm. He was treated with lenalidomide back in 2012 and actually responded to that for 3 years. He had a nice correction of his anemia. But then in 2015, he started to require transfusions again. He tried azacitidine, but actually wasn't able to tolerate it very well and wanted to try lenalidomide again. So we restarted him on his lenalidomide. I had first treated him with his lenalidomide. That's when I met him. Because there is a case series out of Germany of patients with myelodysplastic syndromes who are cycled on and off of lenalidomide and actually regained some of their responsiveness. I told you the story earlier of my twins with a DDX4-1 abnormality. Those are the sorts of people in whom you can cycle lenalidomide on and off, and it works later on. There's also a case series out of Germany looking specifically at patients with refractory anemia with ring sideroblasts and thrombocytosis that shows a responsiveness to lenalidomide. In his case, unfortunately, his second exposure to lenalidomide did not work, and he's back to being transfusion dependent.
You said he had problems or intolerance of azacitidine. What was the problem?
You know, it's so rare. I have to say over 90% of my patients tolerate azacitidine very, very well. I will often tell the story. The oldest person I've treated with azacitidine was 99 years old. And he was a guy who walked 3 miles a day. So you may look at me and say, you're nuts to be treating somebody who's 99 years old. What were you thinking? But this guy was 99, walking 3 miles a day, who said, I still have a lot of years to live. Do what you got to do, right? That's someone you treat. But very rarely I will get a patient who just gets very sick to azacitidine, is bedridden or couch-ridden for 4 weeks of getting a cycle. I'll be able to talk them into getting another course of treatment. The same thing happens. Often they're hospitalized more than once, and they say, forget about it, I'm done. And that's kind of what happened to him.
Going back to the lenalidomide, can you talk a little bit about where we are today in terms of lenalidomide and non-5Q disease?
Sure. So lenalidomide is FDA approved for lower risk MDS patients who are transfusion dependent, so dependent on red blood cell transfusions. And in those patients, lenalidomide works approximately 2/3 of the time in rendering these folks transfusion independent. The median duration of that response is impressive for MDS. It's over 2 years. In Europe, there was a phase 3 study of lenalidomide that randomized patients to getting placebo, lenalidomide 5 milligrams daily or 10 milligrams for 21 out of 28 days. Those patients on the lenalidomide groups had a transfusion independence response rate of over 60%. So in lower risk deletion 5q MDS patients, lenalidomide works, and the overall response rate is approximately double what we had seen for previous drugs in this population. And that's why it was FDA approved, with a durable response of 2.2 years. In these patients, it works at the level of the deletion 5q clone. So it works on the MDS clone. In patients who don't have deletion 5q, who have lower risk transfusion-dependent MDS, this is not specific to their MDS clone. So it probably, in those patients, works more on some of those pro-apoptotic, pro-inflammatory cytokines. Probably works through VEGF, which of course is why it's teratogenic, why there were birth defects associated with thalidomide, and why lenalidomide is on a REMS program to prevent use in people who are potentially pregnant. But in not working on the clone, it renders patients who were previously transfusion dependent to being transfusion independent about 27% of the time. The duration of that response is also much less, at about 32 or 33 weeks. So it works. I do have my poster children for it in non-deletion 5Q, in whom it has worked for years, but it doesn't work as well as it does in deletion 5Q.
So let's go on now and talk about your 65-year-old lady.
Sure. I saw a 65-year-old woman who about 5 years ago initially presented with fatigue and some dyspnea on exertion. She underwent standard workups for people who were 60 years old with those complaints. She underwent a GI evaluation and didn't have any GI blood loss. Her vitamin and iron levels were checked. Those were all normal. And eventually she had a bone marrow biopsy that showed at the time, a normocellular marrow with 40% cellularity. She had trilineage hematopoiesis, so everything looked like it was working well. And she didn't have any major dysplastic abnormalities. She did, however, have an increase in ring sideroblasts, and it was thought that she might have refractory anemia with ring sideroblasts, even in the absence of significant dysplasia. She eventually was started on darbepoetin, and she did have an improvement of her anemia. By that point, she had started to require transfusions, and her transfusion frequency decreased. So I include her because she's the sort of person who has one of these mushy diagnoses, right? We always talk about the very clear-cut myelodysplastic syndromes, or we talk about how great it is that patients have molecular analyses, and then we can distinguish whether they have an ICIS, idiopathic cytopenia of undetermined significance, versus an MDS. Here's a case where we can't. In my state of Ohio, insurance will not pay for molecular analyses. So my patients have to agree to a $1,000 fee for us to send a mutation panel. And she said, thanks, but no thanks, I'm not interested. So we're left with what we're left with, right? We have somebody who has some cytopenia, some anemia, who's suffering from it, who doesn't have an official myelodysplastic syndrome diagnosis. And here's someone in whom I would feel comfortable giving an exogenous hormone like darbepoetin, but I would not feel comfortable giving a chemotherapeutic like a hypomethylating agent, because I don't have an MDS diagnosis to hang my hat on.
Interesting. So let's finish out. You were talking before about the research on the patients of Hiroshima, and I see you have an 89-year-old man who actually lived there. I guess it was after the bomb.
Yeah, so this is fascinating. And actually, there's a recent story, I believe, in the New York Times just a couple of weeks ago about veterans who were tasked with cleaning up the Paradise Islands after the nuclear bomb explosion. And there's a photo of a man wearing this yellow jumpsuit that's supposed to be for protection. And he reveals in the story, oh no, they just had me put that on for the photo. Wow. And the rest of the time I was in shorts and a brimmed hat.
Wow.
And how these folks are not getting coverage for subsequent cancers and other maladies for their exposure there. So I actually have, these are all, you know, real patients, an 89-year-old man who lived in Hiroshima for 18 months after the atomic bombing during World War II to kind of help with cleanup and getting people resettled in that area. So he had an exposure. He's a guy who developed pancytopenia a couple of years ago, and he had RAEB2. He had 15% blasts in his bone marrow. So he's a real, for sure, higher risk MDS patient by blasts, and he had normal cytogenetics. He's somebody we started on azacitidine, and he did well on it. He actually had a complete response that lasted for 14 cycles. Unfortunately, after that, he relapsed. And not only did he relapse, but he came back with a blast percentage that was 20 or 21%. So he technically evolved into acute myeloid leukemia. He is somebody we tried on a clinical trial, because once someone has been exposed to hypomethylating agents and those agents have failed for him, we really don't have a lot of options. In his case, unfortunately, the clinical trial didn't work. The drug didn't work. And when we offered another clinical trial, he said, thanks, but no thanks. I just want to be followed, and please give me transfusions when I need them.
So what's the follow-up with him right now?
Well, for now, his transfusion needs are increasing. He's getting blood weekly. He has started to require platelets. We've had a discussion with him about, you know, his goals of care, and we bring this up regularly with him, not because we want to hammer him over the head with the fact that his disease is at an end point now and he's going to die soon, but because we want to make sure that it's a discussion topic, that if he wanted to go back to therapies, we could try that. He's in good physical shape. He's a sharp guy, just to make sure he knows that that's still an option. He's not quite ready for hospice, and hospice in this population is tricky. A lot of hospice organizations consider blood and platelet transfusions to be extraordinary measures. For our patients, we look at it as basic quality of life, but not all hospices agree. So it's a tricky conversation to talk about hospice with somebody who's at the end stage of myelodysplastic syndromes. And often what we'll do is cobble together a plan that's a mixture of supportive care and hospice.
What would you be thinking about right now if you were much younger, you know, in his 60s, for example?
Well, with this sort of MDS, if he were in his 60s, I would have initiated him on a hypomethylating agent. And while he was in remission, he did have a complete response. We would have tried to get him into a bone marrow transplant. The only cure for MDS is a bone marrow transplant. So for somebody who's younger, open to it, doesn't have a lot of comorbidities, we encourage a bone marrow transplant almost at diagnosis of higher risk disease.
So anything else that we haven't covered today? I'm going to look back on some of the notes I took based on some of the work that you've done, but any other things that you want to bring out? I think we've covered most of what I wanted to cover, but let me just ask you, anything else you want to chat about?
One other thing that we're seeing more and more of is incorporation of molecular abnormalities into prognostic scoring systems. So right now we have a couple of scoring systems that we use every day as our default staging systems for myelodysplastic syndromes. We have the International Prognostic Scoring System and then its revised counterpart. Both of these are fairly easy to remember. They rely on a patient's blast percentage, number of cytopenias, and cytogenetic profile to determine risk and the likelihood of progression to AML and a person's survival. We're finding that we can refine those even better by adding molecular abnormalities to them. So we've published one system of looking at that. The International Working Group is working on a system to incorporate molecular abnormalities into the IPSSR. If you're looking for a ballpark of how to deal with molecular abnormalities in staging your MDS patient, if your patient has poor risk molecular abnormality, you're basically upstaging them one. So if they started out with intermediate 1 disease and they have an ASXL1 mutation, you can consider them to have intermediate 2 disease under the IPSS.